It's good to be back.
Well, I'm John Facci. I play the bass.
I'm Ed Dwyer. I play guitar.
I'm Chris Fisher, lead vocalist.
And we're the Shards.
That's right.
Welcome to the legendary Shards podcast. Mm-hmm.
In the song that seemed to get us... that was getting a little bit of attention off of the what we recorded with Tim, which we eventually called Bootleg, was So Far Down.
Yeah, and that was the song that we didn't even conceive of before we went into Tim's studio.
No, I remember Ed and I a little bit the night before sitting on the couch, well, screwing around. You and was, Christine had gone to bed.
It was, but it was Saturday night. So we recorded on Saturday and Sunday. Yeah. And I think we did, you know, we did whatever, two or three songs since on Saturday. And then you guys, apparently you guys were hanging out and you guys wrote, So Far Down and came in and told Owen and I about it next day. So you came in and said we have a song.
And I had written the lyrics to So Far Down. That was one I had the lyrics for. And that was, I think my inspiration from that was the Doors LA Woman. Well, I've been down so goddamn long. That was the inspiration. But it looks like up to me. But we didn't do that. It was pretty much a traditional bluesy kind of thing. Yeah. That was just where the idea for the words came from for me.
Yeah. Well, we were definitely becoming masters of the dark song. Yeah. And it was, you know, at that point, you know, and our resistance of anything light and fuzzy, we were definitely looking to the depths.
Well, my theory was you had, like, you know, the Doors' first single was Break On Through. It was a little harder for them, you know, so then they could do anything. And you've got a lot of examples of that. Look at REO Speedwagon. I mean, their first single was Hard Rockin'.
Yeah.
And then they end up being, you know, they're doing the other stuff. But as long as you come out hard first, you can then do anything.
Right.
But then if you're like Mr. Big and come out with that ballady thing first, then no one's listening to your hard stuff.
No.
Because they're like, oh, yeah, that band that did the ballad.
Right.
And then you're pigeonholed.
Yeah.
So we wanted to stay very far from the fluffy ballad.
Yeah.
And we did.
Well, we were also no longer vulnerable. We were not going to allow ourselves vulnerable anymore.
No. No. So Far Down was another moment of magic in that experience in Tim's parents' basement at Center Stage Productions.
Yeah. And I remember early on playing our tapes for people. And I remember my sister-in-law commenting on pick up the phone, which was one of our early tunes. And what she liked about your voice was she said that I feel like I can hear him smiling on the other side of on the other side of the recording. It's like, yeah, I think a lot of our, there wasn't a lot of smiling in a lot of our early Shard songs.
No, no, maybe an evil, sarcastic kind of smiling, but no.
Yeah, I mean, so in the, you left Chicago in 91, and I held on for another year or so, and I just could not, I did not have the money to keep up with the lifestyle of going to school, you know, halfway across the country, and of course, it's art school. I know books can be expensive in college, but in art school, you got to continuously buy supplies as you're going. So, you know, that all started crashing down around my ears, and I ended up leaving. At that, in between, say my brother got married, and his brother-in-law turned out to be one of the premier blues guitarists in the Albany market. And we started following his band, Split Decision. And I brought you to some of his shows, mm-hmm. I think. And so they were incredible, an incredible three-piece, you know, power blues band that played, you know, Hendrix, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Santana. And if you can imagine the talent that it would take to for a three-piece band to play Black Magic Woman and to cover, you know, all of the rhythm and the all of the percussion of a drummer and a percussionist. Well, they definitely had the drummer that could do it. And that would be Owen Lewis III. Yeah. We
tried to, the goal was to get Joey to be our guitar player.
Of course,
player.
He was the greatest guitar player we knew.
He was incredible.
Yeah.
I, kind of at this point, I'm in Pennsylvania. I haven't moved up here yet. Joey hears a tape. I don't know. Is that the Reverence Record tape? Have we made that?
I might have heard some of the, like I said, the, some of the songs I was playing for my sister-in-law, his sister, you know, and we started trying to get him interested. I was bugging him all the time, you know, playing guitar with him and trying to learn anything I could off of him. So he started hearing it, and then Split Decision broke up. After a couple of years, and he was starting to look for a new band, put a new band together. So you started rehearsing with him,
yeah,
and trying out for that.
But again, this is pre me being able to sing. So we get in a room with him and a couple other fairly accomplished, you know, musicians. And we start playing things like Tin Pan Alley and Hey Joe and Black Magic Woman. And I can't sing them the way they should be sung, you know. Right. So that becomes, you know, I think I can remember looking at the drummer who immediately is just kind of rolling his eyes and like, who the fuck is this kid? And where the fuck did you get him? You know, I mean, he was none too thrilled. By the end of, you know, probably rehearsal two or three, I don't know how many I got through, you know, Joey's discouraged, and we go our separate ways, which is fine because that's how it had to be, you know. And again, that little bit of experience that I got doing that just helped me that much more get me towards where I needed to be.
And we didn't spend a lot of time playing, you know, cover songs or that. We, right from the beginning, it was about writing our own music.
Yeah.
So there's a difference between you singing your songs that you were writing and singing someone else's.
Yeah.
Yeah. And meanwhile, I'm doing and we actually started meeting and trying out quite a few guitar players. I mean, we really did.
Well, once I got up here, then I come up to Schenectady, and I think we might have even put an ad in the Metroland or something.
I think we did, and just talking to a lot of people. And when I think back on it, there were quite a few that we were really active. I mean, this is what, 93, 94. We're really actively searching at this point. You already started coming up. I got the apartment with our friends and you start coming up and crashing on the couch there. And I've been working landscaping, and that's where I met Ed Dwyer.
At that point, we'd actually played with a lot of people. And nearly all of them, other than our little bit of success with covers with Joe and Jim, it just didn't, a guitarist would walk out or whatever, and it just wouldn't be there. You wouldn't feel it. That night in that room, you felt it immediately. And we pretty much just started writing songs, that I had words for, and maybe John and Ed had noodled with a little bit, but we just started going through them in the Blue Shade stuff, Brothers and Sisters and Blue Shade and Moving On. And,
in that first rehearsal, we had like four new songs that were almost pretty much complete. I mean, they develop so fast.
You and I are on the couch working out So Far Down. Do you remember that?
I do.
That, John and Owen don't even hear, really.
Right.
Until the next morning when we're about to record it. But you remember that?
I do. Yeah. I do. I remember because I had, I remember the equipment I was using. That was that PV amp. I had my row of effects that I had, and a Strat. That was the blue Strat. The Ultra Strat, the 90s Ultra Strat, for all the aficionados who might come across this way.
If you find one, buy it.
Well, you can't. I can't. I ain't got the dough, and you can't find them. But the ones I have now are already off the shelf. You can't get them anymore. I got them. It was just complete open trust, and without boundary, that was that enabled the writing.
Well, that's what the band became. And again, my only memories other than me and Ed sitting on the couch the night before is just being in that little booth and wondering what would happen and worried that I wouldn't come in at the right times.
Right.
This ends up getting us the attention of Scott McPherson, a producer that we'll talk about later. He does a version of this. We have the version we did here, and then, of course, a version ends up on 23,000. And it kept growing through the whole, process, really.
So the tapes did do us well. I mean, it got people's attention. I mean, the radio station, they might have just been desperate for money at the time. I don't know, but they took it seriously enough. I mean, to play it, and even a cassette, the fact that they...
Well, we were on there a whole Saturday night.
Yep.
They played every song.
Yep.
We had people calling it. We would talk about the song, and people would call in between songs.
Yeah.
And it was pretty cool.
No, it was a great, it was a great experience. And because of that, we became eligible to sign with ASCAP. And it legit, all of a sudden, and we weren't making any money yet, but it was... legitimized us, so that was about 2 months. So anyways, we had the tapes. At the time, I think we're still calling it a work in progress. A little collection had is a work in progress. I think that's what we called it. I did a little logo and a little tape cover that we made. We're always very crafty with the covers, things like that. Anyways, that's a whole other story. Anyways, so we're getting it out there, and Ed's the best. I mean, Ed's got the lucky fingers when it comes to hitting it on music. I guess this was lucky. It was a good experience. It definitely was worth the education, I believe. But Ed handed the tape to someone named Scott McPherson, a music producer that was living in the Albany area. And he was looking for people to put on a local Albany compilation CD. And he was interested in including us. So, you know, he took a fee, right? But he liked So Far Down, and that's the song he chose to do.
Well, and his version of So Far Down is the worst version.
Yeah, it was.
He wouldn't let Owen drum. He only wanted to keep the time. He slowed it down. He fucked up my singing. It was not good.
Yeah, but
other than the experience, it was a good experience.
But it was a great recording studio down in Millbrook, New York.
We got about 2 feet of snow that day, but that wasn't going to stop us from getting there.
No, and it was I mean, it was the first time we heard Owen on a quality drum set. And it was amazing. You know, he had his old ladies when we first started playing with him. The whole time, I mean, he used them throughout Split Decision. Well, until just before the end of Split Decision. I guess, some of these things go in cycles, right? So, anyways, he had the old drum set. One of our early mother's shows, he knocked one of the toms off. It was rolling off the stage. It was good effects for a show. Definitely makes an impression. But he had a rough old drum set. And when he got to Millbrook and they had this professional set, and it was amazing. We heard him warming up all morning, and he was incredible. So fast. It sounds so good. It was a really good setup. But once we started playing, we did a couple takes, and this producer is just like, no, you gotta play harder beat, a stiffer, you know. And he wanted to tighten them up and basically really stripped it down. And he tried to add like a little bit of a,
he did with the acoustic guitar, that dun, dun,
yeah,
dun,
a little dun, chord back yeah, up, yeah. And it really, I don't know, and it sounded so plain.
Well, he didn't allow the shards to be the shards, so.
No, he was actually more interested. He had a band that he was actually, seemed like he was working with to promote, and he let us all contribute to paying for their vehicle. It was basically it. And if nothing else, I think other people paid more than we paid. As much as, I think we paid like $500 to get on there. But I guess it was a $500 experience.
Well, it was a good experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, that song grew even from there.
Yeah.
And became really the final finished version
yeah.
on 23,000. But we did that by literally, I mean, all through this period, we are, jobs or no jobs, regardless of the circumstance, we're playing every day. We're together every day.
Yeah.
Once we get into the gallery, you know, we went from Owen's attic where at this point, again, I'm starting on the coke. I'm not in Owen's attic every day. First of all, it's 150 degrees in Owen's attic. You know, these guys are spending like 8-10 hours a day in there. Yeah. Me, I'm out doing cocaine and chasing girls.
But we were literally, you know, we were literally getting in there, you know, at about 8 o'clock in the morning and playing. And yeah. We just start, and whatever happened to those tapes, I don't know. But we would just play for hours. And literally, like, you know, sometimes, you know, half hour, 45 minutes in a row, just playing, just playing. And that was just how we were able to work together. You know, there was really no effort to it. It was just all creativity. Yeah. You know?
And then I think it fit perfectly with, you know, now you're approaching, you know, the halfway point of the record, track five. And our, you know, the anchor of everything is So Far Down.
Yeah.
And that was the first song that anyone ever noticed. We recorded that originally, again, with Tim. And it got noticed a little bit and got us out there a little anyway.
Yeah. And written spontaneously and altered very little. Really unaltered. Well, it's got the most recorded versions, that's for sure. And it got the attention of a local producer who invited us to be on a, you know, a compilation of Albany artists. And that was right off of our first ever demo. So that's why we felt things were moving pretty fast, pretty quickly. But another great song with the lyrics. It just create the amazing imagery. It's a direction, right? It's like so far down. It's so easy to understand. And it's just an electric riff. So we recorded our first demo on a Saturday and a Sunday, and we recorded three songs on Saturday. You and Ed in the process somehow, somewhere, got together, wrote this song Saturday night.
Yes, between the Saturday and the Sunday.
Yeah.
We needed like more songs. It was so early, you know?
Yeah.
And I do remember sitting on your couch, you're in Ed's, you know, when you, Christina, and Ed lived together. Yeah. And you guys had gone to bed and it was very late and he had that riff. And that was another one that I wrote the words for his riff.
Yeah.
No, you know, I might have had the beginnings of the words of that one, to be honest. I might have had the beginnings of that. But, yeah, we just sat there, and you and Owen had never heard it when we walked into the studio the next morning to record it. As we stood there in front of the mics,
yeah,
they had never heard it, and Ed and I had only played it through once or twice, just enough to get an idea.
And it's just a great basic rock riff, and you know, immediately gets your attention, and obviously it did for a lot of people.
And I think, you know, the original two recordings, one with Tim and one with Scott McPherson at CMG on the compilation, neither of them had the ending that this particular version ends up having. And while I don't remember, maybe you do, I think, again, it's a product of rehearsing at that gallery with people coming in and always trying to push it a little further. And we come up with a whole new ending, which is just incredible.
But it was also spontaneous because while we were at the studio at Sweetfish, Mark Fuller brought out that theremin.
Well, I remember him showing it to us and us wanting to use it. Did we actually make that ending that day so that I could use the theremin?
Yeah, that was a part of
the... Well, that's even more impressive then.
Yeah, I mean, it really was spontaneous in that moment. And it really brought it to an epic finish.
Yeah, yeah. The ending really, you know, again, it's almost a bridge at the end. You know, we didn't follow the rules because we didn't know the rules. You know, sometimes we'd use a bridge, sometimes we wouldn't. I've told Tim too, the bridges aren't my favorite thing. I think a lot of times they sound forced and they're the actual worst part of the song. And I always thought I'd rather have no bridge than a bad bridge.
Right.
But this definitely, you know, wraps up the energy and the feel of So Far Down and really added to it.
And it brings almost like a punk feel, you know, that bass line, the bass line, and just the way it just gets rowdy, like all of a sudden too. And it's just a good classic, you know, blues rock type riff to start the song. And but that bridge brings like kind of a wild, kind of almost like a punk feel, which really, you know, brings down the house, I think.
Yeah, and I think, you know, of course the song, I mean, So Far Down speaks for itself. And that ending is just almost that black space you get in sometimes that's, you know, not quite defined and things are weird there. And I know we all get there sometimes. And that end kind of sums it up, that whole feeling.
Yeah, well, we were there when we started this band. We were definitely, couldn't get much lower than where we were.
Yeah.